This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated books and comics show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he is every week, is Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I'm glad to see that you're up and about. You look very lucid, because I know you've been hanging around a lot of these Orion women as we've been preparing for this show. And you know, those pheromones are pretty strong.
Yeah, it is. They are really strong, Chris. Some reason though, I'm mostly immune to them, which is fantastic. And I think it really annoys them, the fact that I don't really pay them much attention. You know, they're trying to get my attention, and I'm just like, guys, I'm busy. I'm reading a Star Trek book. Don't you see me working here? I'm working here. So, I mean, just no respect. You know, they're really needy and clingy and, goodness.
Always trying to drag you into their schemes and plots.
And it's ridiculous, their plots. I mean, not well thought out. Very, very shady dealings. And it's just not me. So, luckily they have moved on. So, I feel bad for the poor schmuck that they are inflicting their pheromones on now.
Yeah, same here. Well, you know, someone I think is not a poor schmuck being influenced by Orions is Jeffrey Lang, because he is hard at work on Light Fantastic, which we've talked about here before a little bit, and this week we have gotten a glimpse of the cover.
Which means, Chris, it's time for another edition of We're Gonna Rate Your Cover, We're Gonna Judge a Book by Its Cover, because if we don't, how will people know whether they should read it?
Yeah, that New York Times bestseller list stuff, not a good indication of whether you should read a book or not.
No.
Literary Treks, judge a book by its cover.
Exactly.
That's what you need to go off of.
Unless your cover is sufficiently exciting. Then
yes.
No, you should not read this book. So,
well, let me ask you, Matthew, do you think this cover is sufficiently exciting? Because I'm not quite so sure myself.
You know, Chris, it's interesting. I think it's sufficiently interesting, this cover. You know, it is a nice piece of artwork, I think. You know, this isn't just a, you know, a picture of, like, Data. Somebody's actually done the art here.
Right.
To mix the Noonien Soong face with the Data face to give him that look that he has now after the Cold Equation series. And, of course, knowing that he was rebuilding his daughter Lal, who is also there as well, and so, you know, this looks like a very interesting book. Now I do have to say, I've had a conversation on the Trek BBS boards with Jeffrey Lang, and I was just talking about some of my reservations a little bit about the book, and you know, he mentioned really Margaret kind of wanted them to really push the boundaries, you know, with Data and just do something very different. They're not
right.
Saying he'll never be in Starfleet again at all. They're just really kind of pushing those boundaries. And David Mack joined in on the conversation talking about how, you know, they really wanted to explore the idea of, can an android have a soul? You know, and if he does, what does that mean? And you know, so and the whole question of personhood and who is Data? Is this really Data? You know, or is he like a clone of Data now? Or you know, all those kind of questions that we get when we go through this. So I think that made it a very interesting conversation when we think about it as in Star Trek terms, and it makes me a little bit more excited for this book. You know, this cover, I think really is reflecting that idea of what does it mean to be an artificial life form, you know, and is Data even artificial now that he is so intertwined with who his father was and who he was? And so there's a lot of big questions, and I think this cover reflects that. So I would say this is sufficiently interesting.
Well, from what you just told me and that conversation, I would agree that is sufficiently interesting. On the Trek Collective, the little blurb that they put above the cover image in their story on this said that the cover has almost a religious image to it, or a religious look to it. And I think that maybe religious isn't the word that I would use there, but spiritual. Like, what does it mean? What is the nature of existence, and what makes us who we are, even if we started out as an artificial life form, as Data in that case? And I can see what they're getting at there. So this does sound like an interesting story. Sufficiently interesting.
Sufficiently interesting. That's the new one, Chris. We're going to have to, you know, obviously everything could be sufficiently exciting, because not everything is going to fit into that mold. And so hopefully soon we'll have that stamp of approval. Apparently we now need one for sufficiently interesting as well.
Right.
And it needs to be different from sufficiently exciting, because we don't want people to get confused.
And after the feature today discussing the Orion sisters, we're also going to need a sufficiently sexy stamp as well.
That is true. You know, I don't really think we get a lot of those covers. In Star Trek Lit, I think we do that on, you know, Literary Treks After Dark.
That's
and
right.
Most of that is just Char's slasher fic.
Well, so if you look at the comic cover I chose for last week's episode, I did use the cover from the Orion comic, and it's a little bit racy.
Yeah, I gotta say, I'm surprised that one did not get a parental advisory on it, because, yes, you are right.
Could
it looks a
one.
Little bit more like Victoria's Secret Orion Edition cover than it did necessarily a Literary Trek. So, goodness, folks.
I think on Orion, that's called Dinesh's Secret.
Oh, yes, Dinesh's Secret. You know, what's really weird is she honestly doesn't have any secrets.
No, she doesn't.
I mean, Victoria may have, like, maybe one or two.
There's a few, yeah.
But Dinesh, no. So.
All right, well, let's go on before this goes any further off the rails here and jump into the Seeker series. And Dayton has confirmed that the Seeker series will be continuing for at least two more books after the two that we have coming up, and has given us a little bit of information about the outline that, as he calls him, his co-conspirator, David Mack, has helped put together.
Yeah, this is exciting. David's already put together the outline for the third book, and then Kevin and Dayton will begin figuring out what the fourth book in the series will be next spring, it looks like. You know, these are very much standalone tales with respective crews of the Sagittarius and the Endeavor. And so, you know, will the two ships team up again? They say possibly, but they're not necessarily in a rush to do that. So this is exciting to see. You know, I think it's great to have something in the original series universe, again, that's not, you know, TOS, 5-year mission. So this is great.
Yeah.
I think this is fantastic. I'm really glad they're doing this.
Well, and I would say Margaret must be very pleased with the books to go ahead and say we're going to do a third and a fourth even before these come out. And I'm sure that when these come out, and if they follow the trend of Star Trek books recently and they hit the New York Times bestseller list, If the guys are up to writing more and more of them, I could certainly see this as becoming a long series.
Definitely. You know, they all very much enjoyed getting to do the Vanguard series. And I think they're excited to be working with some of those characters again that we saw there. And I think it's something that they're they're sufficiently excited about, honestly, Chris. I know that David Mack and I know that Kevin and Dayton very much really enjoy this universe and kind of getting create without some of the limitations you get
right.
when you're doing
exactly
the yeah. Original series characters. Yeah.
Well,
so
well, and even Vanguard, because you know it had become very complex. So I think that as a creative, you're always looking for new ways to express the ideas that you have, and the format of mm-hmm. these books feel like they might be a little bit more fun to write. Maybe they're a little bit more like, here's an idea and we can explore this in this new, more compact format and mm-hmm. then go on to the next idea. It seems like it's a fun project, I think, for them as writers. And so I could see them, you know, really enjoying that.
Well, Chris, we've got something really interesting here. You know, IDW had done its limited series, and they had given us the ongoing limited series, which, as we saw then, was really expensive. But some really, really cool artwork came with it. Obviously, things being signed as well by artists and writers. Well, they're doing it again, but this time with the TNG Doctor Who crossover assimilation. And this is going to be released in May. Now, again, collectors, this is going to be rather pricey. I mean, the starting price here is $75 with all the way up to $300, $350, Chris. I just, an exorbitant amount of money for this comic series. But hey, you know, if you're like me, you're a huge Doctor Who fan and you like Star Trek, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's definitely for collectors, but the images that they've shown so far, it looks really, really nice. Now, that is Amy Pond there on the cover, like right dead center, right, Matthew? So you're going to have to buy this.
It is. That is Amy Pond, right dead center. You know, if I wasn't going on a vacation in May, I might think about, you know, doing this, but I just think that it might not be the right time for me to be dropping $75 to $350 on something like this.
What if Amy turns her head and looks straight at you from the cover?
Chris, if that happens, I will buy it.
I thought so.
Yeah. But I don't think that's going to happen. And I mean, you must remember, I have met, the real Amy Pond and I have my picture with her. So I, you know, even if she does look at me, I've already had her look at me before. So I'm not sure it's worth $355.
All right. Well, keep trying
but
to talk yourself out of it, Matthew.
I do have to say, Chris, for those collectors who really love this kind of stuff, yeah. who really love the comics, this is fantastic. There are six different versions, and like we said, it goes from 75 to a little over 300 there. So there are some great categories you can choose from price-wise here, Chris. So not too many worries. There's also different color options. There's a red and a blue series, and each one of these has each one of these price options that they have also comes with slightly different things with it, you know, whether it's signatures or artwork and whatnot. So pretty cool. In fact, the highest ranking blue and red, there's only 15 of each. So
yeah,
you really are limited. Getting something that is very hard to obtain.
Yeah. So we'll put a link in the show notes to that as well, and you can go see the images if you're interested. Again, not for the casual comic fan or comic reader, but definitely for those who love Star Trek and Doctor Who and are collectors, I think that these will be quite popular. Well, Matthew, that's all we have in news today. But before we jump into the feature, where we're going to be joined by Dan Gunther, who writes the site Trek Lit Reviews and also writes the book reviews for TrekCore.com to talk about the latest Enterprise book, Tower of Babel. We'd like to tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. Audible is the best source for audiobooks that you'll find online. We tell you that every single week, but we really do mean it. I've been getting my audiobooks from Audible for 14 years, so I couldn't live without them. And if you love podcasts and you're not getting audiobooks right now, you really need to do that. They have over 150,000 titles available. They add hundreds of new titles every single week, and they have new releases, current bestsellers. They have science. They have history, arts, business, lots of Star Trek books as well. Anything that you can imagine, they have there. And we like to recommend a book every week. And this week, because we just talked about Doctor Who, Matthew, and the Star Trek crossover that they did, they actually have a lot of Doctor Who novels in audio format on audible.com. And in fact, they have two Doctor Who novels by our friend Una McCormick. They have The Way Through the Woods, and they also have The King's Dragon. And the first one, The Way Through the Woods, is narrated by Mira Sayal. And the second one, The King's Dragon, is narrated by Nicholas Briggs. But, you know, Una loves her Doctor Who. And if you haven't checked out her writing in that area, this is a good way to do it.
Definitely, Chris. I myself need to check out some Doctor Who novels, and I think this would be a great place to start, especially since I love Una's writing, so I'd love to see her writing the Doctor.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have not read her Doctor Who books either, but again, because I love her writing so much, I might check these out myself. And if you'd like to pick them up, you can get one audiobook absolutely free just for trying Audible as a Trek FM listener. And the way you do that is go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up for the trial. And you can choose any book you want absolutely free. And if at the end of the trial period you decide Audible's not really for you and you want to leave, that's no problem. There's nothing to lose because you get to keep that audiobook. That's yours. And by supporting Audible, you'll be helping us keep Literary Treks coming to you every week, and you'll be getting some great books in the process. So go check it out, audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really thank Audible for their support of Literary Treks and the network.
Chris, it's really exciting today. We're going to be discussing the second book in the Rise of the Federation series, Tower of Babel by Christopher L. Bennett. And we have a special guest with us from the Treklit Reviews website. He is the runner and founder there, Dan Gunther. I'm really excited to have him, Dan. We've been friends online for a while now, and so it's great to finally have you on the show.
Well, thank you. It's really good to be here. I'm pretty excited to be on the show.
Welcome, Dan. Now, are you going to sing also like Matthew does on the show?
Well, I couldn't hope to match his talent in that area.
I just took a drink of water and almost spit it all over the keyboard because that's how untrue that statement is.
I'm diplomatic.
Apparently. He's like Archer over here. Well, give me a little, just a real quick rundown, Dan. One, how you got into Star Trek and just, you know, how you started getting into the books and then, of course, doing the website.
Okay, well, I've been a Star Trek fan since I was really young. I think I actually remember my mom bringing home a rental copy of all things Star Trek, the motion picture. And I was just, I can narrow it down to seeing those Klingon ships fly past the camera. And I was hooked. Like, I was like, oh, what is this? This is amazing. And yeah, I watched the original series on reruns. I think it was Saturday mornings on CBC here. And yeah, as everyone else was watching Saturday morning cartoons, I was watching Star Trek. And
excellent.
Then one day, you know, I found out there's another Star Trek that's on the air right now and started watching TNG in the fifth season. And I've been hooked ever since.
Do you have a favorite series?
Oh man, that's a tough one because, I mean, TNG is great. I always have to go with, for writing and just all around awesomeness, I got to go with Deep Space Nine, generally.
There you go.
Hey, Chris, I think he can stay.
I think he can stay, yeah. You passed the test, yeah. You can stay on the show, so, Dan.
That or he could be just being diplomatic because he knows what we do, the orb.
Yeah.
If only I had my Betazoid senses.
Yeah, no, Deep Space Nine, I feel like it's kind of the series that it was the first one that I watched from beginning to end as it aired. And yeah, it's just always had a special place in my heart for sure.
Yeah, I'm very much the same there. So how did you end up finding the novels? Were you just like perusing the library one day, or?
Well, I had read a few novels as a kid. I think I remember getting Q Squared by Peter David as a gift from my aunt and uncle once. And I think over the years, I've probably read that one about 10 times. Yeah, just kind of whenever I saw them, I'd pick one up and read it. And it never got really serious as far as like wanting to catalog and do the website and stuff until a couple years ago. And basically, actually, the impetus for that was I know that I had read the A Time 2 series. I could not remember a thing about them. So, yeah, basically I just started the blog kind of just for myself as like a catalog of, you know, the books and what I thought of them. A few people started reading it and I was kind of shocked, like, oh, people are actually reading this. Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. It's kind of grown from there, which has been great.
That's great.
Definitely. Yeah, I feel the same way. I'm like, wow, people read my blog? What? Wow, they really don't have anything better to do. we all have read the first book, and you know, I know Chris and I both loved it, and Dan, I know you did too. So just coming into the Tower of Babel and finishing the story, just kind of overall impression of this book and kind of compared to the first one for everyone.
Generally I tend to really enjoy Christopher L. Bennett's approach to novels, and I was pretty impressed with this one. I think like we all know how Christopher Bennett is with continuity and tying things together in kind of unexpected ways, which is always a little bit of fun for me. So generally I was very impressed by this novel. He also does characters very well, which is something I gravitate towards being a Deep Space Nine fan. So generally I've been pretty impressed with both books in this series. And, yeah, this one in particular, I thought was pretty good.
Chris, what about you?
Yeah, I enjoyed it as well. It's, I'll see how I feel at the end of the discussion after hearing what you guys think about it. I overall maybe liked A Choice of Futures a little bit better than Tower of Babel. I'm not sure exactly why. I think because maybe we got to see, I liked the bits in that book about how the Federation was coming together and how the different races and the technologies and such were coming together. And this one has more of an action story with it, with the kidnappings and all the political machinations that, you know, we were talking before the show on the other side of the book, that this is a book that you have to read slowly or maybe read twice to take it all in, because there's a lot of complexity to it. And I think that you're right there, and I'm going to go through it and read it one more time, which may change my opinion of it a bit as well. But overall, I enjoyed it, and there are a number of nice callbacks here as well. I say callbacks. They're callbacks to some things we saw in the original series, even though in the timeline they haven't happened yet.
Yeah, and not only that, but again, Chris does a great job of having callbacks to things from Enterprise. Mm-hmm. And I think that the strength of his storyline is that he is pulling from the series instead of just kind of creating new things that like a fan would do. You know, he's actually pulled from the series to create situations from that. So like by using the Orions and all of those different races that the series itself created, instead of kind of just using what, you know, we as fans might have used if we were kind of coming up with something. And I think that's one of its main strengths. I did like this book. I found myself reading it slower than I usually do, just because there is so much going on and like the different levels. I mean, each storyline has at least three different levels of machinations happening within it. And so therefore, if you're not paying attention, you're totally going to get lost. Yeah. You know, You can't skim this book and get it. You really do have to read it, which I think is great. But it does mean you really got to pay attention. And so, and I think it's resolving some storylines from A Choice of Futures, but it's also then creating these kind of new threads that he can pick up for what's going to come next, because we already know he's going to be writing more, which is fantastic. I honestly can't believe that Pocket has really put a lot of faith in the Enterprise series, but I think it's awesome because this is the kind of book that actually means something to me as a fan, because it's adding something to my knowledge of like Star Trek in a way I don't normally have.
Well, I think that's the thing, that it can be of interest to Star Trek fans in general because of the fact that it's about the building of the Federation. But at the same time, it is very much an Enterprise book in that I'm going to say you need to know these characters. I don't know if you need to know these characters in order to enjoy the story, but definitely if you know the characters, the story is much, much richer that way. Maybe you could jump into it and pretend like you don't know who any of these guys are, and you can still follow the course of what's going on and the debate about what the Federation should be, what's going on, the Rigel system and such. And of course, you know about the Orions already, so it can still work, but it is an Enterprise book.
Yeah, like it's kind of one of those things where, you know, there's a lot of things that were introduced in Enterprise, and given how it's treated by some fans, the temptation might be to just kind of leave that all aside, wipe the slate, and begin anew. But I think it's really great that he's used what's already there and built upon it rather than, you know, just trying to go off in a totally new direction.
Well, and I mean, you know, when you're bringing in aliens that, again, you have to pay attention to the series, you know, the Maulerans, you know, the Mutes, all of these kind of races that, you know, just had one off episode. I mean, and not necessarily even popular Enterprise episodes. You really have to have paid attention, but and made it really interesting. And I think what he's done here is do what Kirsten Beyer did for Voyager, which is take well, for me, Voyager was just not great and created something really awesome. He's taken Enterprise, which was good and average and sometimes great, and really made it consistently great. And made those episodes that you didn't maybe love actually mean something now.
Yeah.
So when you go back and watch them, you're like, oh yeah, and then they're going to do this and this and this. And so it actually makes it mean more. You know, in the same way that, for me, the Clone Wars TV show made the prequels even better because it made it, you know, mean something more. The characters meant something more because I got to spend more time with them. So I think that's really great.
Yeah, I think that in my written review of Protectors, I said that Twisted, which, you know, the book followed on from, was the definition of a meh episode. And Kirsten Beyer really made it interesting and brought interesting concepts out of that. And I feel much the same about Civilization and the Enterprise episode where Garrus is from. It's just kind of a very middling, yeah, okay, that happened episode. And, you know, to see the reverberations and the what came out of that, great, you know, really excellent.
I come on, Archer gets action in that episode. That's not meh.
Admittedly, poor that guy did not happen very often.
I mean, the guy got his ass kicked more often than not. So, I mean, the only time he got some action, I was like, I like this episode. This poor captain needs, you know, something else to happen other than get punched in the face repeatedly.
I kind of actually loved that Bennett kind of brought that up in this book. How Archer's kind of reflecting, like, oh man, you know, I've had dalliances with like three women and two of them were, you know, playing me. Like, what's going on here? It was kind of great.
Yeah, I love that too. So, well, some of the things that we kind of come up in, and this was, I think, one of the issues that we see in the book was this kind of early idea of the Prime Directive. And Enterprise always kind of played with that idea that, you know, and there's even a quote where Archer says, one day our people are going to figure out, you know, something, a rule you know, some sort of directive that gives us the idea of what we can and can't do. But until then, we're figuring it out as we go. And there's a great quote in the book here when Malcolm is talking to his security officer, Williams, saying, look, we're out here to explore. We're not out here to police. And I just thought that was a really interesting idea, is that they are slowly kind of moving closer and closer to this thought process. And you've seen it in Archer. You obviously had it in T'Pol the whole time. But I thought it was great to see really that formation of what Starfleet is going to be, you know, by the time we get to Kirk. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's going to throw it out the window all the time, yeah. But still,
well, you know,
they're going to have it.
He even in the second chapter, he's talking and he points out the Vulcans, which was interesting to me because Archer is so anti-Vulcan, you know, early on in the series. But he says, for centuries, the Vulcans have practiced a similar philosophy toward contact with other races. It helps guide my own beliefs about the Federation's responsibilities in interspecies contact. So it really shows how his experiences over the years have brought him around to see that what the Vulcans were doing that pissed him off so much when he was younger and before the NX-01 even launched, he starts to understand maybe why there's a reason for that. And as he's now kind of guiding the formation of the Federation, he's using that experience and wisdom to help guide others who don't yet see the value in that.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, that's something that I think Christopher Bennett's done really well, is shown that, you know, these characters have grown over the years and changed their opinions. And I mean, some of that was like the third and fourth season of Enterprise. But there were times where I felt Enterprise was very much going the way of Voyager, where, oh, these people are just in kind of the same jobs for 4 years or 7 years. Right. And not really changing. And that's something that I think this book does really well with all of the characters. And yeah, with regards to the Prime Directive, you know, it's great to see kind of those building blocks and Archer really being the one who's like, you know, I've been out there. I see the kind of damage that, you know, these philosophies can prevent. And yeah, it's great to see that sort of evolution.
Well, and I mean, what it shows as well is for somebody like Malcolm to say this, the guy who's like, can we just blow some crap up all the time?
The you know, king
to,
of kaboom.
To have moved, exactly, to really have moved forward into this role of captain and really kind of living out these ideals, mm-hmm. to see that that's become his thought process shows just how much he's changed as a character. And I think it's well done, and it's not out of the blue. I mean, this is 10 years after the Romulan War. I mean, so that's, mm-hmm. that's quite a few years, after the end of the series of Enterprise as well. And so, I mean, a lot has happened to these characters. They've been through a lot. They've been through a massive war.
But it's not just changing the character though in the story, but also we get to see, there's a moment where we actually get to see Reed reflect on how he himself has changed when he realizes that in becoming a captain and thinking in that way, he's also given up the fact that he used to be very suspicious of everything as an armory officer. And you can tell, like, he feels like he's lost something of himself. And then T'Pol has to point out to him that, no, that's actually growth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and to that great scene towards the end of the book where Malcolm is talking about why, what he thinks is happening. He's laying out the plot scenario, and, you know, T'Pol and Archer, they're kind of on the fence, and he says, look, I trust my people. And immediately, because of the conversation that him and T'Pol had earlier in the book, she says, okay, I'm with you. And then Archer agrees as well. And I thought that it was fantastic to watch the way that these characters, you know, they know each other so well, but they're growing in their respect for each other, and they're growing into their respective roles as well. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really fantastic.
Absolutely. You know, especially with like Reed, because earlier in the book, he was kind of feeling like, oh, they don't really trust me as the captain of my own ship. You know, they got to send T'Pol to kind of ride shotgun and make sure I'm doing okay. And, you know, that really wasn't it at all, but that kind of little bit of insecurity there. But then, you know, when it really comes down to it, they show him that, you know, no, we trust you. You got this. It's all good.
Yeah. Well, and it too, you can tell, I think sometimes still that Archer would like to be the person in the middle of it all. And
right,
he's still even in some ways getting used to his admiralty. And talk about, you know, we just got to mention this, you know, usually badmirals, I mean, but seriously, Archer probably is the quintessential good admiral. And so, especially somebody who was moved from captain to admiral, we don't see that all that often, at least in the televised show, and that go well. But hey, got to give Archer his props here for that. So,
absolutely, yeah.
Chris, this is something that you had talked about, so I kind of wanted you to lead us in here. You were just talking about this idea of the Federation identity crisis, and what was it specifically there in the book that really got your interest and peaked in this area?
Well, I think early on, at the beginning of the book, of course, we have this case of this colony that they're boomers, basically. Did you know they're born in space, Matthew? Those boomers?
Actually, you know, luckily Mayweather reminds us that he was in space.
Uh-huh. Was he?
And basically that he had been born in space. Was nice to get that. Because I always forget.
Yeah, I must have missed that time that he mentioned that. But apparently, yeah, these boomers are born in space. But we have this colony, and they are in Tellarite space, and they don't want to move. They're there because they don't want to be part of this Federation. You know, they want to be their own people. And the Tellarites are butting heads with T'Pol and our people, because even though they're all together now as part of the Federation, there's that growing pain where they don't want to work together yet. And so initially you see that, and you see that sort of identity crisis for the Federation of like, are we united? What does it mean for us all to be together, Tellarites and humans and Andorians? Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, as you get more, and of course that gets resolved because the book jumps, you know, like a few months at a time and then a few days at a time, and it takes place over the course of a year or so. But as you get later on, you start getting into all of this debate between the Federalists and the Planetarists, is that how they've named them here? And these different groups who they want different things for the Federation, you know. And there is that debate of how much autonomy should each world have? How much of the government should be centralized? How should they deal with trade? You know, how should they deal with military? And we've talked about this before. I think we've talked about it since the time we talked about A Choice of Futures, but this is at a point, and you have Section 31 involved here as well. And this is at a point where the Federation can go in different directions, and it can become like a very loose confederacy and a very free society that allows a lot of autonomy for its member worlds while working together for the greater good, or it can become a very dictatorial society where you actually have a very strong centralized government, which would end up being on Earth in the case of Star Trek. And that government would really be oppressing everyone else and trying to force everyone to stay together, which of course is completely impractical over interstellar distances, which is one of the things about Star Trek that you kind of have to suspend disbelief a little bit, because mm-hmm. a lot of what's talked about in this book, I'm trying to take it all in as general, this is how we deal with our own society on Earth and the decisions that we make. Because if I really think about it as these worlds are really this far apart from each other, then you start to think like this is a little bit silly at times, because these things actually don't matter over such great distances, because there's no way that you would be able to hold them together or enforce anything in the first place. But it's anyway, it's that identity crisis of what are we going to be that gets played out through the book that I think, as we were saying at the beginning, makes this story interesting to general Star Trek fans because, yes, it's an Enterprise book, but this is sort of what we wanted to see on the TV series and we didn't get because it ended after four seasons. The whole jump ahead to Archer's speech at the end of These Are the Voyages wasn't enough. You know, like, how did they get to that point? That's what we wanted to know. So seeing that play out is interesting.
Well, what had gotten actually cut out, though, was it actually ends a lot like Grease. everybody just dances right. and sings about, we go together like... ding, 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 dong. It's pretty much just like that. Olivia Newton-John is...
See, they should have faded out from that with the music going on. Then you pull out...
Exactly.
You pull out of the holodeck into the corridor of the Enterprise yes. D, but you still hear the exactly. music. Yeah.
Yes. See, that's what we had missed is that's how everybody comes together. They just have a big, huge musical number right. and it's great. Yeah. So, I think that was what was really interesting too was seeing how these worlds want to work together. I mean, you know,
or don't want to
the
work
Vulcans
together
and the, right. Well. They, you know, the Vulcans and the humans have worked together for quite a long time. And so they have a better idea, I think, of how to do this. But, you know, this is still relatively new for the Tellarites and the Andorians to be working together mm-hmm. like this. And for the for the Andorians and the Vulcans to be working this closely. And then, of course, adding all of these other different worlds, you're compounding it, the problem as well. And we see the idea of kind of like pulling in something like Rigel that's not necessarily as set in its ways as like an Andor or a Vulcan or even a Teller. All of those are very much set in what they're going to be, whereas something like Rigel has just had a huge upheaval and completely changed. So and how you add those to the Federation and what that looks like is all being discussed here. And I thought that was a really interesting thing because you really are having a identity crisis.
You know, one thing there about Rigel coming in is that I thought that little bit showed the road that the Federation has to travel that we see later on in Star Trek about how they decide who can be admitted. Because when you get into the TNG time period, you get conversations about how, like, well, this world isn't ready for Federation membership yet. And mm-hmm. there's a point in this book where they're talking and they say that what's going on here may be symptomatic of something that we haven't been able to make peace with those who are right in our midst. Those are some of the Rigelians talking. And I was thinking that actually becomes a prerequisite for Federation membership down the road, that if a world is not at peace with itself, then it's sort of automatically disqualified from consideration. But at this point, the Federation is trying to grow itself, so they're much more lenient about these things.
Right. Yeah. Cause I mean, in the Rigel system, you have the Kalar, which are, completely kind of cut off from the rest, you know, sort of by choice, but also kind of exiled there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I feel like, you know, in the Next Generation, we'd have a whole episode kind of debating about, you know, well, what's that about? Is that okay? Is that not okay? And yeah, it's kind of, in this time period, the Federation is kind of just has to add numbers mm-hmm. to kind of become a legitimate actual thing that's going to fly. Whereas like later on when it kind of is this big, huge government, they can be a little bit more selective or kind of take that more into consideration.
Right.
Well, Chris, I think one of the other things that really comes out in this book that we see is just the political realities of the galaxy at this point. And in a lot of ways, the way that they kind of reflect our world. But I wanted to ask you guys this. Did any of y'all get the feeling that you had seen this kind of before and it's actually in the 24th century? And I say that because, you know, the Federation is forming and growing, and its enemies decide we need to form a union as well. and we all know that now in the novels is the Typhon Pact. I thought it was very funny that at the beginning of the Federation, its enemies were trying to do the same thing, not quite as successfully, but that the story was really mirroring the 24th century in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of, I feel like the Typhon Pact, you know, it's very much a kind of counter-Federation, and in some ways kind of trying to pick at the Federation and pull it apart, like kind of engineering the secession of Andor, but at the same time mostly just kind of trying to counter that power with its own, whereas here it's more like trying to keep the disorder and chaos, keep the status quo rather than, you know, having all these powers kind of join together and present a united front that would make, you know, kind of their criminal enterprises and their more lawless frontier type dealings a little harder to do.
Yeah.
I think the difference with what we see here versus, say, the Typhon Pact too, though, is that those races that form the Typhon Pact are more traditional spacefaring races or societies like we're used to in Star Trek, like Klingons, Cardassians, these types of societies. Of course, those aren't the ones in the Typhon Pact, but they're that type of society. Whereas here we're dealing with criminals, you know, we're dealing with Orions and we're dealing with traitors and criminals and slave runners. And they don't have internally, it's just like crime syndicates trying to come together, as opposed to groups that actually have governments and militaries and well-rounded societies of their own. And so that's why here it doesn't work for them. But whereas with the Typhon Pact, they are actually able to bring together that group.
Yeah, kind of trying to create like protection rackets as opposed to kind of an actual set counter to the Federation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was something that I just thought was a really interesting thing. I was like, wait a minute, I feel like I've seen this before. And then, of course, the political ramifications of what we see, especially with we see this there on Rigel with, you know, these corporations kind of running things. I felt like to me that was very much just this is a vague reference to America and just kind of the way that we run things these days with our, you know, our secrets, we know your secrets, and we're just going to kind of keep each other in check with our secrets. And then of course, very much that kind of Cold War feel, like, you know, the Russians, we've got these nukes, the US, we've got these nukes, and if we both fire them, we're all dead. Mm-hmm. So that's the way we keep the peace. Very much that idea as well. So,
Yeah, no, I mean, you can do little things like invade Afghanistan, but, you know, if you really, you know, want to mess things up, well, we'll mess you right up right back.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of this book, and I won't go into it too much here on show, but apart from the business side of it, I also see a lot of this book feels like commentary on American politics over the past four years. Some of it seems so direct that there are moments where it feels more like Christopher L. Bennett's own commentary on what he's seeing play out in the news in the United States today versus the actual formation of the Federation itself. I mean, there are definitely parallels there, and any sort of political dealings are going to have these similarities. There are moments, though, where I felt like it was so, and maybe that's not what he's doing, and maybe that's me reading that into it as well, but it really felt that way at times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there are certain things that are kind of endemic to pluralistic societies and creating governments. But yeah, I think there's a certain amount of, you know, ripped from the headlines, so to speak, playing into this book for sure.
Which is natural. I mean, that's, you write about what's going on, so.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah.
Well, and I mean, this was one of the things that I thought was really interesting too, and it really works into these kind of ideas that we see in the formation of the Federation, just kind of some of the differing ideas. I mean, the Federation has its progressive side, and then it has kind of a conservative side, and kind of meshing all that together. And some of these quotes from the book, especially like where they are talking to the Rigelian leaders, Saval and Archer, and Saval talks about this idea that, you know, people mutually consent to abide by these rules for their collective benefit. The idea that, you know, absolute unfettered freedom is just a ridiculous idea. We band together for the collective good by allowing some of our freedoms to go by the wayside so that we mm-hmm. can have a mutually beneficial society, which is a really interesting idea. I guess you could almost say that you kind of have to have some sort of absolute belief that that's the best way to live. It's just an interesting idea. Like, you have to base that on something, and it's what you base it on, I don't know, other than this is what's best for the most amount of people, especially if you're a Vulcan.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of the, you know, my rights end where yours begin, or my right to swing my fist ends at your nose kind of thing. Like, it's, you know, yeah. We have personal freedoms, but we still have to live together. And, you know, some of those freedoms for the collective good are need to be not curtailed, I guess, but kind of respectful of everyone else's rights as well.
It's interesting for me to see this debate play out in Star Trek and in this book because of the fact that with the Rigel system itself in this book, there are so many planets and there are so many different species and races that are all Rigelians, but they're actually different from one another and they all have to come together. And then the Federation has the same situation. Whereas you mentioned the Vulcans I feel are a lot more like we are here in Japan, whereas the Federation and the Rigel system overall is a lot more like America. Whereas like you guys in the States have to deal with so many different groups and different interests, and it's a melting pot and everyone has to come together. And you see the struggle and you see how divided the society is, and this debate is continuous. Whereas in Japan, the society runs much, much more smoothly because what you're describing, Matthew, about how you have rights up to a point, but you also have to respect others. And as a group, you agree on a framework that works well for the entire society. That's more how our society works here in Japan. So we don't have the kind of continuous strife that we see in the news from the U.S. or that we see here in this book with the Rigelians or the Federation. So seeing the debate on both sides here as they have the political discussions in this book is really interesting to me because I've experienced both ways of a society operating in real life. And so I have a personal experience of how this approach works and this approach works. And I know which one I prefer, and seeing it, how it plays out here is maybe a unique experience for me anyway.
Well, and two, you know, I think one of the things you see as well, the juxtaposition of you know, these, the Federation's enemies trying to come together and the Federation itself trying to get them together, and the idea of really doing this for the benefit of others and for yourselves. Whereas people that are all about them and their own power, their plans tend to fall apart when they try to, you know, partner with anybody else because they're all about them, you know? And I think this idea of this completely selfish living, this hunger for power really destroys, and it really corrupts. You know, obviously absolute power corrupts absolutely. And that's been seen over and over and over again. And so I think we really do see those political realities playing out today. Political parties care much more about their own power than they do their constituents or anything else. Yeah. And so, and I don't really care what side of the aisle you're on because you both do it. So, and you know it. And if you are not going to admit to that, then you're just a fool. And I think it's something that really bothers me just about the political system. And we really kind of see that play out in this book, and that the idea of really doing the best for the most amount of people, and especially in a political system that we're really trying to help those that we are elected to serve, is a really nice idea. I just wish we saw it more in the real world. I think maybe that's one of the things that we do like when we look at Star Trek. We're like, man, whew, if we could only get there, that would be right. Really nice.
Yeah.
So. And I think the ultimate illustration of like the juxtaposition to that is the Saurian dictator in this novel, who's, you know, very obviously using, trickery and coercion to get more people under his rule. Which is just the exact opposite of what the Federation is doing, which is, you know, coming together for mutual benefit and convincing people that it's actually going to be in their best interests to join together for strength. Whereas, and I'm blanking on his name right now, the Saurian dictator, his idea is he just wants to rule the entire planet and then eventually more, by the looks of it. Just for his own personal power.
Well, and the Rigelian first families too, who are willing, mm-hmm. basically when Garrosh realizes they don't really care. They just want power. They're right. willing to destroy their whole financial system basically just to be in power, even just of a smaller area, even if it's just the Rigel system. And so, yeah, you see it all over this book, these plans and these schemes, these Machiavellian type schemes that are just imploding on themselves because they can't handle it. Even seeing it too with the Orions and the Three Sisters, mm-hmm. They're all inner working against each other, and it just leads to ruin. And so it's really interesting. And on top of that, this other idea is kind of in here, and it has a lot to do with the Trip storyline, fighting for a nation while losing its soul. Mm-hmm. And we saw this play out. T'Pol even talks about this with Trip, the Vulcans before the Reformation, and Trip seeing this happen with Section 31. And even, you know, we see this play out in other Star Trek. Mm-hmm.
Again, I thought that was reasons I love Deep Space Nine.
Exactly.
And this is also one of the ripped from the headlines moments in the book for me as well, because it's exactly what's happening in the U.S. right now with the, you know, protecting the nation, but undermining its values at the same time.
Right. And that, you know, we can't protect what we want to protect by actually betraying that very Federation, right. Which is what Picard says in Insurrection. Yeah. You know, been known to call him pompous Picard, but he was definitely right in that scene that you can't do this.
Yeah.
And really then still be who you are, because, you know, and I think this was the greatness of it. It was the beautiful playing out of that the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And Trip has all the best intentions, and he always has. You know, we saw it play out in the series. He just doesn't always do necessarily the best thing, but he always had the best intentions in heart. And I think this struggle for Trip's soul is a really interesting part of the book and a really interesting part of the series. Now, we were talking about this a little bit on the other side of the page, but we already know where Trip's going to come out, because the end of the Romulan War book already told us the end of him and T'Pol's story, that they end up on Vulcan together with kids. And so we already kind of know where this is going to go, but I think getting there is going to be a really interesting, just a really interesting journey. Yeah. So.
Well, I love that he's kind of like, oh, well, maybe if I stick with this Section 31, I can, you know, ride it out and make sure they don't become corrupt and they, you know, keep on the good path. And, you know, good job there, Trip. We all know that worked out really well.
Yeah. It's so hard not to get sucked into whatever group you're a part of, you know, mm-hmm. and just become that. You know, they always say, you know, it only takes one bad apple to ruin an entire barrel. And, you know, Section 31 really is a whole barrel of bad apples with maybe one good apple in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, your odds trip are ever not in your favor.
Well,
to quote
remember,
another series,
Section 31 has a zero tolerance policy towards good apples.
This is true. This is true. Which really plays into as well. And we see this in the book. This idea that secrets and their ability to destroy everything, because they always come out. I mean, the entire Rigelian system is based on knowing each other's secrets. I just thought that this was really interesting.
So it's like that iPhone app secret then, right? Where you can send people the messages of what you're doing.
Yeah. Or, you know, like Snapchat, where you think it's going to be, you know, and somebody screenshots you and you're like, you son of a. Yeah.
All right. Goodness. We'll go on with your serious thought, Matthew.
I just thought that was a really interesting point of the book, that we keep seeing these secrets and people trying to hide their secrets, and then mm-hmm. they keep coming out. We see that with, you know, Archer's girlfriend in the story, Sedna. And it, again, with the whole Rigelian system, with Mollerns trying to keep their secrets as well, the Orions and their plan upon plan upon plan, and you know, it's just insane. Mm-hmm.
They all just feel just like that time bombs really about to go off, you know? Like.
Exactly, exactly. And that really, in the end, I mean, it's the axiom, the truth will set you free. It's just so much easier. And I think that that's the main difference here as well with the Federation and its founding and what it's trying to be and everything else that we see around it, that they are trying to set up a system based on the truth and truth, justice, and the galactic way. And so instead of, you know, anything, you know, lies and deceit and all those kind of things, they're trying to be transparent, which is, you know, them trying to get Rigel into the Federation and trying to figure out exactly what this system is. What are their secrets? And are they ready to be admitted into our Federation at mm-hmm. this point? It's a really interesting conversation.
Yeah, and I find it really interesting that that debate is kind of going on while they're presenting themselves to Rigel, because
yes.
Rigel's kind of seeing these two sides and saying, like, what are you trying to get us into here? You know, what are you exactly? And they're like, well, you know, we're kind of united, I promise.
Well, I think
we're like semi-united.
Yeah.
Well,
the United-ish
feels so good.
Of planets.
United-ish.
Yeah. Semi-united, and it feels so good.
I told you, Dan. I can't keep Matthew from singing on the show, and I don't want to. Because it's very
see
entertaining.
It firsthand. Wow.
Dan, you mentioned the Saurian dictator earlier, and although the Saurian storyline is separate from the Rigelian storyline, I think what's similar here is that this is the normal mode of operation for politicians in general and in our world as well. And so the reason why the Rigelians are so suspicious of the Federation's motives just stems from the fact that you become so conditioned that the idea that someone wants to come in and actually help you and do something that is for the betterment of the society is so foreign to people that you're naturally mm-hmm. suspicious. And so
yeah, you're constantly wondering, well, what's the catch here? You know, really? Okay, no, what do you really
there's want? Even the view in here in the book of the Klingon view of the formation of the Federation, which is that the Terrans conquered the Andorians and the Vulcans and pulled them into their empire. So everyone has this view of you're always trying to conquer, or you're always at least trying to get something for your own benefit. You're never trying mm-hmm. to do something to help. And I think that as much as the Federation internally having the struggle to figure out what they are going to be as they try to expand, they face this challenge as well. And the Rigelian system is a good choice here because of the upheaval internally and the way things operate there. with the secrets that we're talking about, and with the business and with the trade and with the crime syndicates as well, to put this challenge to the Federation.
Yeah, I thought the kind of alternate viewpoints on what's going on were great because, you know, they're not wrong from the Klingon point of view. You know, like that's your mindset. That's how you approach.
Right, that's your mindset.
Everything yeah. you see. And like you say, it's such a foreign concept that, you know, people would actually come together for mutual benefit.
But I think it's important. I think it's important in a Star Trek story to point that out, though, because we're accustomed to the 24th century and even the 23rd century, but especially the 24th, where if someone has that reaction to the Federation, you as the viewer, as a Star Trek fan, feel like, well, what are you worried about? Come on, we're the Federation. I mean, everybody in the galaxy knows that mm-hmm. we're nice. And it seems too yeah. easy at that point, right? So I like your pointing out that in the early days, it wasn't like that. Everyone was suspicious.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And I mean, it's, if I can just kind of bring in Babylon 5 here for a second. I absolutely love the one thing they do is they kind of show, you know, spoiler alert, if anyone's ever going to watch Babylon 5, the Earth government.
I like that how you said, you didn't say if anyone hasn't yet seen it. You said if anyone's ever going to watch it.
No.
Okay, go ahead with your...
It's kind of one of the things, like they become dictatorial and that sort of thing. And a lot of people kind of forget that in the 30s, Germany, for the time, yeah. was, quote-unquote, a first world nation. Like that term didn't exist at the time. Like they were heavily in debt from the war and that kind of thing, but they were a modern European nation at the time and Hitler was able to take power. So I feel like a lot of people say things like, oh, that could never happen now, or that can't happen to my society. And I think the Federation is kind of the ultimate expression of that, because by the time you get to the 24th century, you say, no, that could never happen to the Federation. But here, especially in the 22nd, right at the beginning, you know, they're at a crossroads with infinite numbers of different paths they can take. And some of those paths are pretty dark if they let it happen.
Yeah, and it really, I mean, it goes to that whole idea of you know, what's the soul of the Federation going to be? And it really plays out well in the struggle we, again, are seeing with Trip. And of course, the struggle that all of these characters are having, like we talked about with what's the identity crisis the Federation's kind of having, the idea of the Prime Directive, what's Starfleet really going to be like as we're moving forward and all of that. And I think this really comes down to something that the book does well is character arcs from Archer to T'Pol. And then as we talked about the way that Kirstin has been really taking those Voyager characters and making something of them. I mean, the thought that I would ever have liked Chakotay as a character was mind-boggling to me. And yet, in her books, I think he's fantastic. Harry Kim is an enjoyable, likable character there. There's so much done. Yeah, exactly. And so... Bennett has done the same things with a character like Malcolm or a Mayweather or a Hoshi, really, mm-hmm. really bringing out what was in these characters and making them something, you know. And I think that it was fantastic to see some of the great quotes we got from Mayweather when he was defending the Federation to his captors. I loved watching Malcolm struggle with being a captain because he's not the most personal. I mean, he reminds me a lot of this, the kind of like an early Picard might have been, because he's not personable.
Oh, that's a good point.
With people, you know, he's like a proto Picard. I love that as well. And I think too, you know, watching this growth in Archer of, you know, struggling with, have I given up so much of my future because I've been worried about what's out there instead of what's right in front of me, which I thought to me was a very poignant lesson, that I'm so worried about what's going on, what might happen in the future, that I might miss what's right in front of my face. And as human beings, man, don't we do that all the time?
Absolutely, yeah.
So what did you guys think about the actual character arcs in here? That's, you know, Archer's situation and the fact that he doesn't have a lady friend in his life. He's really hooked on his work, and he does have a little moment in here. But it feels like in the end he does come around, and he finally asks Danny out. And do you guys want to see that go somewhere?
I'm curious to see where that goes. Again, speaking of an episode that, you know, wasn't that spectacular, her character from Daedalus in season 4, kind of one of the few misses of that season. It was interesting to see her, and while I don't think they did a lot with her character this book, I'm kind of curious to see what they do with her coming up.
Yeah, I found it to be an unexpected combination, personally. It's good, you know, mining, like you said, from that episode, but I didn't see that coming.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of wanted him to end up with the Rigelian, honestly, just because it would have been a little bit more interesting, I thought, because I seeing, you know, that kind of cross species relationship, you know, mm-hmm. and to have Archer be the first person to really have that other than Tripp and DePaul, I thought would have been really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And it made sense too, because I feel like Archer is one of those characters where you can really explore the idea. So I was a little disappointed that it didn't go that way. I understand, I guess, why, you know, it felt a little bit more like, I don't know, too much of the trope.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it would have been a little bit more satisfying for me if he had kind of ended up with Sedna, and pursued that relationship a little bit more. Especially in the idea of forgiveness and moving forward and those kind of things, but also just it opens up a lot of great story possibilities. The thought that, you know, an admiral in Starfleet could be one of the first big characters on the scene to have a cross species relationship.
Mm-hmm. Were you guys kind of disappointed that, you know, she ended up betraying him? Like, when they kind of got together, I was kind of like, oh, please don't let this be a betrayal thing.
I don't know. I felt from the very beginning, and this is another thing about the book that disappointed me a little bit, is that I felt that the plot twists in the book were a little bit too transparent. Like, there was really not much of anything that caught me off guard, and I was suspicious of her from the very, very moment that she kissed Archer. I knew who the gunman was who attempted the assassination all the way from the very beginning. I even made a note the first time we encountered him that, okay, he's up to something. This is why he's scanning Archer. So, I wasn't really surprised that she was involved in betraying him.
Mm-hmm. I think the one thing about that was kind of her motives, that it wasn't, you know, just a cut and dried, you know, bad kind of thing going on. That was kind of, it redeemed it a little bit, but I was, like you said, I was suspicious right at the beginning, as soon as she was interest.
Right.
That's where I really felt like it would have meant more to the storyline if he had pursued then a relationship with her. It would have made it not seem so tropish, like, oh, I had to betray you because, you know, like, I can't help it, you know.
It's what I do.
My family and yada, yada, yada. We had a bisque. I felt like I would have enjoyed just a little bit more of that if it had gone, that she actually did like him, you know, but right. She's also being forced to do this. And that makes it a little bit more interesting than just, well, you know, I seduced you and I kind of had to. And
well, so. I think she does admit at the end that she does like him because she said she couldn't really go through with the plan because he was so nice. But when she initiated everything at that point, it very much was just that's why she was there. And it was
right
after the fact that she realized that maybe there's something more there.
And as Steve Jobs would say, one more thing. I'd like to just briefly talk about the coda to the book. And if you haven't already, we didn't say this, but we're spoiling the crap out of this book. So right. If you're still listening, I feel sorry for you and you haven't read it. But the very end of the book, what did you guys think about what Bennett brings in?
I kind of thought that was brilliant because I remember actually that was one of the earlier episodes of Enterprise that I really, really enjoyed. And it was kind of really cool to see that space station and that technology again. And, Roxanne Dawson does that creepy computer voice so well. And mm-hmm. I totally heard her voice at the end there. I thought that was great. That made me really excited to kind of see what was coming next. You know, like the Choice of Futures had the mute aliens from that one episode, which I thought was great. So it's kind of nice to see another big bad threat kind of looming on the horizon.
Yeah, your inquiry was not recognized. Final line of the book. And
I can't do that, Dave.
I thought it was really cool too. I mean, it was completely unexpected, but now I'm really looking forward to seeing if, and I hope that this is going to be explored in the third book in Rise of the Federation, because if it's not, then Christopher, you're a real tease for putting that in here. But I thought it was really cool because Dead Stop is such a great episode and it's a great mystery as to why that was there. And now the idea that there are lots of these spick and span, clean, white space station repair stations out there, and they clearly are there for a malicious purpose. And of course, we know from Dead Stop part of what that purpose is because of what they do with Travis, but we don't really know what the bigger plan is of, like, why is it there and why are they trying to lure humanoids in and hook them up. So,
yeah.
So it was a cool coda. I liked it.
And the tentative title for the next book, I guess, is Christopher Bennett said was Uncertain Logic, which, I just assumed, oh, it has to do with the Vulcans. Okay. But, you know, logic could have to do with computers and how computers mm-hmm. think. So that's kind of made me wonder, ooh, you know, whose uncertain logic are we going to be exploring in the next book?
And that could play into the whole trip to Paul relationship as well. So mm-hmm. that title could apply to a number of threads that we can see pulled through the next book.
You know, I thought it was a great tease for the next book. I remember that episode too, because it was one of the first times that Enterprise was showing you that it wasn't going to be afraid to do continuity. In direct Absolutely. Continuity right. for what happened last mm-hmm. week. I mean, that was even one of those times where they're like, last time on Star Trek Enterprise. And it was wonderful. I mean, I just rejoiced when that happened. Yeah. And the thought that there are more of these stations out there freaks me out. So I am interested because, again, Chris is mining the series and not just kind of like creating this feeling that we all kind of thought this might go, you know, this series might go.
And
in fact, Chris, when we talked about this, the next book coming out, when we heard what the title was going to be, I think we automatically jumped to Vulcans immediately as well. Yeah. I mean, we would never have even thought of pulling out the random space station in the one episode in the first season.
Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that, like, I remember a lot of people kind of complaining about things like that. Like, oh, this is not explained, you know, where did this come from? But it's almost like the creators left these little nuggets for authors to pick up and run with. Like, wow, you know, you come up with the story. Where did this come from? And I don't know. That's really exciting. I'm excited to have that explored.
And let's not forget that we also get to find out the origins of the Venus drug in this book, which was a great callback to Mudd's Women.
It's one of those things that he does so subtly, too, that, you know, and it works so well. Like, if you're not paying attention, you might miss it because it's one of so many things that happens in the series. So, it's one of so many things that happens in the book that I really appreciate about Chris is he'll just kind of throw in something. And you know, it's really for the person who knows Star Trek really well.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes his books well worth reading.
And the thing is, like, none of it is just for the sake of doing it either. I mean, like, that drug to counter the Orion female's influence, like, that has a real impact on the plot. I think Christopher Bennett on the Trek BBS board once said, when someone was talking about continuity porn and, you know, how they don't really like just random stuff thrown in, I think he said something like, I use continuity to serve the plot and never the other way around, right? I don't do continuity for continuity's sake. I do it because it actually moves things forward and makes sense to the plot of the story.
I think this is a great time, Chris, to talk about maybe just some final thoughts and give our ratings for the book as well. So, Dan, what are your final thoughts?
Well, I was largely very impressed with the novel. Like I said, I've generally enjoyed most of everything that Christopher Bennett's written. I really liked the continuity coming together and the character work that he does. Trying to decide on a rating to give it. I'm going to give it 9 Venus drug pills.
Oh.
Nice. I like it.
That's going to make the book very attractive to readers.
Yeah, I'm already more attracted to it as we speak.
Well, I enjoyed the book as well. I talked about how I felt that the plot twists were rather transparent. And I still feel that way, but at the same time, it's a very complex book because there's so much going on. And I like the discussion that's in the book. I still can't decide if I like this book better than A Choice of Futures, though. Kind of like A Choice of Futures a bit better, I think. But there's a line at the end of the book where the presidential candidate is withdrawing from the race. And I think that in the speech, he sums up the point of the book, which he says, rather than rushing to an extreme of centralization or of individualism, we must find a balance between the two, a balance we can only arrive at by working in partnership with our political opposition. And it applies to the Federation internally, and it applies to the Rigelians in that system, and it applies to just us as people and the message of Star Trek. And so I thought that summed everything up pretty well. And I'm going to give this book 7 Saurian hot tubs.
Oh, goodness. We didn't even get into the Saurians like that. Oh. Well, you know, I'm with both of you. I think I really enjoy Chris's books. Chris Earl Bennett has a amazing way of taking continuity and making it really work. Department of Temporal Investigations is a classic example of that, weaving a story that just blows my mind when I read it because everything works together so well. I wonder what his spreadsheet looks like to try and keep all these story points in line here because really, and I mean this literally, each part of the story has at least 3 different things going on in it, if not like 10 or 12. So it does take a careful reading, but I think that makes it a fantastic story. And it speaks to just the complexity of trying to create something like the Federation. I mean, it's not going to be an easy process. I mean, whoever said this is going to be easy didn't know what they're talking about. So I think it makes for a great book. And there are some things that I was like, huh? Or as we talked about, I would have liked to have seen maybe better, especially in the Archer storyline. But on a whole, this is a great book. And I love the Enterprise series. I'm so glad that Pocket is going to be continuing it. And I'm glad that they've got Christopher helming it. I mean, I think they picked the right guy for the job the same way that they did with Kirsten Beyer and Voyager. And now if they could just pick the right person for the Deep Space Nine book line, I would be ecstatic. So I'm going to be rating this book 8 out of 10 Maris seductions.
Ooh.
So.
Ooh.
All right. We've got seduction, we've got Venus drug, and we've got hot tubs in our ratings. So this better.
It's a saucy mix. I mean, we're getting a little cheeky here.
So the book just became really a lot more exciting.
It's sufficiently exciting, Dan.
Exactly.
Well, all right.
Well, Dan, tell everyone where they can follow you online, where your website is, and where they can see your reviews.
Okay, well, like you mentioned, I maintain my own kind of Treklit blog, and you can find that www.treklit.com. It's kind of a redirect URL, takes you right there. My reviews of new releases also get republished on trekcore.com as well, which is really exciting. That was kind of a development that happened last year. And yeah, I have Twitter at treklitreviews, facebook.com/treklitreviews. Pretty easy, pretty much across the board there. So yeah, if you want to follow my reviews, I also have news about upcoming books and that sort of thing. Yeah, you can find that all online. Pretty easy to find.
Well, Dan, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It was a pleasure to get to have you on the show finally. I can't wait to have you back to talk about some other books we already have lined up as well. And so I appreciate your reviews. As somebody who has to review books as well, it's always great to have another opinion. And so I appreciate all your work, too, for just getting the books out there to people, making them more visible to Star Trek fans. I think it's really important. And so I really do thank you for all the work you do and can't wait to have you back.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much. And likewise, I always check out your reviews. And like I said, I've been listening to Literary Treks from the very beginning, and I love the work you guys do. It's very much appreciated. It's been a lot of fun to be on the show, and I'm really looking forward to doing it again sometime.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thanks for joining us, Dan.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, Matthew, it was really fun having Dan with us today. It's great when we discuss books together, but like you said, I really like having another opinion. Having three of us together works really well.
Yeah, it really does. I really enjoyed it. I think it worked well. I'm glad we will be having him back soon to talk some other books with us. And yeah, I think it's great. You know, like you said, just having a different opinion really does help the show. This is definitely a book that you needed more than two people talking about because there's so much going on in it.
Definitely. Yeah. I know I was reading it and I was thinking about what are we going to talk about? And when I read or watch episodes or whatever, I always have Omni Outliner up and I actually make outlines as I go. So I had a lot of points there, but I was still thinking, okay, how are we going to approach this book? I'm really glad Dan is with us today.
Yeah, it worked out so well. And this is a fantastic book. I really did enjoy it. I think everybody will enjoy this book. And so, I want to encourage everyone, you know, we are going to be getting more Enterprise books, but we won't continue to get them if you don't go out and buy them. And we have had a great run of bestsellers here. So let's continue that trend.
Absolutely. Well, Tower of Babel was great to discuss, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about on the network this past week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Montgomery Scott.
It's really just there to tell a story that they couldn't tell with Kirk or Spock or McCoy.
This is true. An episode where Kirk is framed for the murder of a hooker would be...
Right. Awesome.
Completely different. It would be awesome, but...
Earl Grey.
Ships of TNG Part 2.
Commander Riker, why would you protect the inferior ship? I want its treasure. I want the other ship.
Darren, how long have you been keeping that one in your pocket? You
tell us. That was good.
Do a Ferengi.
The Ready Room.
Scientific Method.
She tells the woman that comes on the bridge, and she's like, "Well, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter to me. I'm going to drive into these stars. It's going to be great." Like, it's like, I'm just like,
the orb.
Till death do us part.
His are very quizzical in nature. They're of the scientist. They're of the somebody who is willing to accept, okay, what is this reality? What's going on? She's just all like, tell me what to do right now. You know, like,
right.
There's nothing spiritual about her.
To the journey!
One versus doctor's orders.
I was working full-time on top of being a full-time student, and I...
Listen, I don't want to hear your excuses, okay? I don't want to hear them.
Like, life was happening, and...
A great man once told me, if something's important to you, you make the time. Warp 5.
Undeveloped Enterprise Stories.
But the idea here is that Porthos would become intelligent and would be the only member of the crew capable of communicating with a canine alien. So even Hoshi apparently couldn't figure out this dog language.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Biff Bull, Chimera.
I'd love to see an X-Files one-shot with Scully and the hookers.
With, you know? Scully and the hookers?
Yeah.
That's a great name for a band.
We can call it Scully and the Hookers.
Melodic Treks.
Five musical favorites.
You know, I don't completely hate the opening theme. I just really think that Archer's theme should be the opening credits.
Continuing mission.
Star Trek Axelar with Alec Peters.
That's what we posit. We say it makes sense that at this point we know it's from TOS. They're not integrated, so our crews are not integrated, and we make a point of that. We don't avoid it. We make a point of it. And in Prelude to Axanar, they talk about that.
Literary Treks.
IDW Alien Spotlight Part 1.
Well, Chris, it's okay because they can see the Romulans from their house.
That's right.
So... from space, you know, you betcha, you know, that's okay. I can see the Romulans from my starship. It's going to be fine.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week. And some days we even have two shows for you. And you'll find them in a wide variety of places, including iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from the website. And if you haven't visited our new home in iTunes, be sure to do that. We have had a great development with Apple. Apple has invited us in as a key provider to the iTunes store and has given us our own section within the store. And we currently have one massive artist page, and then we have 19 pages altogether breaking down all of our content. We're highlighting different themes each week as well to help you find older episodes of our shows that maybe you haven't heard. And it's really easy to get there. All you need to do is go to itunes.com/trekfm, and that will take you directly to our site inside the iTunes application. And we really thank Apple for extending that special invitation to us. And we thank you guys too, because it's thanks to all of you listening to the shows that Apple recognized us and extended the invitation in the first place, because it's something that they only do for a few key providers. So we really appreciate all your support of the shows as well. Matthew, since our last show, we've had some feedback from listener Christopher Baca in San Antonio. And he wrote to say thank you for us talking about one of his recent letters here on the show. But he also said, what do you guys think of the Shatnerverse novels? I really liked Ashes of Eden, and I thought The Return would have made a pretty interesting follow-up to Generations. It would have made up for how awful that movie was. Okay, well, I have to disagree there. I don't think Generations was an awful movie. I actually quite like it, but I know many fans feel that way, so I understand where Christopher's coming from here. He also says, we never really got the great Picard-Kirk team-up that we were promised in the film's promotion. I also liked the whole Mirror Universe arc from the Shatner books as well. Have you listened to Ron Moore's commentary to yesterday's Enterprise? Yes, I have. That was actually a really good one. And so, Matthew, what do you think about this? Now, you are more familiar with the Shatnerverse books than I am. What are your thoughts on this?
You know, I have read all the Shatnerverse books. Most of them are very good, and I say that. I just really enjoy them. One, you don't have to know anything else about any of the other books. You know, there's no continuity from the 24th century you need to know about at all, and honestly, I really did like the way that he brings Kirk back to life. I thought it was kind of a crazy, smart idea, and you know, Borg nanoprobes, the Borg joining forces with the Romulans, trying something new, much in the same way where the Borg had joined forces with Voyager, you know, against species 8472. I mean, it made sense because we would seen that. So I agree completely. The Picard Kirk team up was lame in Generations. I don't think it lived up to its potential as a storyline, but I really just think that had to do with Brandon and Ron being tired and giving their all to All Good Things. And by the time they got to Generations, they were just tapped out at that point. They hadn't had any rest. I honestly think that maybe they shouldn't have been the ones writing the story anyway. You probably should have brought in maybe a Nick Meyer or something to get you into Generations. It would have helped. Anyway, we're armchair quarterbacking. That's what geeks do best.
It was intense. They had so much going on at that time, and that was a lot of stress on them. And I think they did a good job in the end. Generations definitely could have been a better movie, and it definitely could have had a better Kirk Picard team up and a better closing for Kirk himself. But I don't think it was an awful movie at all. I kind of enjoy it. But I think that eventually here on Literary Treks, we will get around to the Shatnerverse novels at some point. I would certainly enjoy exploring those and talking about those. So, Christopher, thanks for your message. And for everyone else, if you would like to send us feedback, you can do that in several ways. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Literary Treks, and that will come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show, about the novels, the comics, anything about Star Trek. And if social media is your thing, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and also on Twitter, where we're tweeting away about Star Trek all the time under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, when you're not, doing those exercises to build up your resistance to Orion pheromones, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me at the Twitter, Matt Rushing 02. It's not really exciting name. But I wanted people to be able to actually find me, you know, instead of being like, I am Bobby Soxer Part 2. You know, like, what does that even mean?
We don't want to talk to that Matt Rushing 01 guy because he doesn't know anything about Star Trek.
That's true. That's very true. Yeah. And of course you can find me doing The Orb with you, Chris, where we talk about Deep Space Nine. And I do have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. I do movie reviews, other book reviews, talk about things that just aren't on my mind. And so you can join me there as well. Now, Chris, when you're not sitting in a nice Saurian sauna, completely comfortable, as all Saurians are. Where can we find you?
Well, I'm comfortable there, but I get a little bit nervous because there's a lot of germs in that sauna, as we find out. And so, you know, I do an alcohol rub down when I get out of there.
It's just a rumor, Chris. It's just a rumor.
Well, it might be just a rumor, but, you know, I went with it when I got back to the ship. You know, I said, I got to go do the whole decon chamber rubdown thing. And Commander Hoshi said that she could help, so.
Well, that's fantastic.
Now, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere on social media under that same username and on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, besides doing The Orb with you, Matthew, I also do Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. I have an interview show about science and creative and other topics kind of related to Star Trek called Matter Stream. And I do Continuing Mission, which is all about fan series and independent productions. And then on the Ready Room every week, I host along with other hosts from all around the network, and we talk about Star Trek news and all 5 live-action Star Trek series. So check out those shows and find out what we're talking about there as well. Before we let you go, I'd also like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks online. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible. Go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up. Choose any book you like, one of Una's Doctor Who books, as we talked about news, or any Star Trek book, or anything else you want. And if at the end of the trial period you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep that audiobook. But by supporting Audible, you'll be helping us keep Literary Treks going. So go over to audibletrial.com/trekfm and try it out today. And we really thank Audible for their support of Literary Treks and the network. One more thing you can do to help us keep Literary Treks coming to you each week is to make a donation to the network. And I'd like to give a shout out to listener Greg Mullenby, who just made a donation. We really appreciate your help, Greg. And your contributions to the network help us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth, because although our shows are free to download, they're not free for us to produce, and we really appreciate your help in keeping everything going. If you go over to trek.fm/donate, you'll find different contribution levels to choose from, as well as some original alien illustrations. And those are available as art prints and badges, so you can mix and match, choose what you want. Again, that's at trek.fm/donate, and we really do appreciate your support in helping keep the network going.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.